Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host. I am delighted to be able to escort you about a bit of what we think of as the battle space of the war for the free world. With, starting off, our first guest, a man who chronicles these events with the kind of authority and clarity that few others do, particularly in a period when so many in the media are simply not covering these issues at all. He is Rowan Scarborough. He has written for many years for the Washington Times and Human Events. He is the author of a marvelous biography of Donald Rumsfeld and innumerable other columns and articles that commend him to us. And Rowan, it's great to have you with us, particularly to talk a bit about this Benghazi bit. We have been told that there is a timeline, and you have written in the Washington Times that it sort of smacks of a cover-up. Tell us what you know, based on particularly what happened last week in these hearings.
Well, I think, Frank, as more actual facts have come out in the last 2 or 3 weeks, it's clear that not only was the attack not spontaneous, but there was not a demonstration at all. I mean, they have gone through the security video that was fed down to the embassy in Tripoli, and they cannot find anybody outside the walls to that consulate until 9:40 p.m. when suddenly the invasion began. So the question is, how could the Obama administration come up with a storyline that this was a spontaneous demonstration that turned into a spontaneous attack on our consulate? How could they come up with something that was so unbased in any actual fact? And the only conclusion you can come to is that it was sort of an on the run cover up, that they did not want to acknowledge that Al Qaeda was still a force. Number one, and number two, they knew quickly after the attack that they had made some bad decisions on security requests for that very building. They denied security; they sent security home. So that's why I think it's become clearer that there was some sort of an on-the-run cover-up that kind of materialized slowly, and it culminated in Ambassador Susan Rice, September the 16th, going on national TV 5 times and saying it was a spontaneous demonstration that led to the attack. So I think that is what has become clear, Frank, that somewhere along the line, people in the White House changed the facts to fit the talking points the White House wanted.
Yeah. And just so we're very specific about this, Rowan Scarborough, what they changed was that this was a terrorist attack on a facility that we were operating there in Benghazi under diplomatic cover, it appears. They're now calling it a diplomatic mission, not a consulate. And that it was all the result of some video that no one had seen or really even heard of that had been out for a couple of months and was cited as the precipitating cause for problems elsewhere, notably in Egypt, but had no bearing, as best we can tell, on this particular event. And Rowan, you've been around this town for a long time. You've covered a lot of national stories, including not a few scandals. You know that, generally speaking, the cover-up winds up being more of a problem than the initial offense. Do you think that's likely to be the case here?
It could be. It depends on they're having trouble now pinpointing exactly who changed what and who concocted the story, okay? But, you know, part of it is mitigated by James Clapper, who is the director of national intelligence. He is the one who put out in 2 days after the attack that this stemmed from a demonstration, okay? He testified behind closed doors last week, and because the hearings were classified, it is unclear why he stuck to that assessment in the face of the CIA in Tripoli, the DIA at the Pentagon, eyewitnesses on the ground in Benghazi, all saying there was no demonstration, that this was a planned al-Qaeda-type attack. And since we were not in the room, we're not sure why Mr. Clapper came to this conclusion, and then how the White House handled that conclusion based on the facts that they knew 2 days later that his conclusion was just wrong. And the DNA, DNI would admit today, you know, that I was way off base in that conclusion. But I mean, they've had 5 hearings now, and they still cannot pinpoint exactly who came up with this story, but they believe it was done at the National Security Council, which is run by, you know, mostly by political appointees. We know
right.
that.
Right. Rowan, let me ask you this. This is not the first incident in which Lieutenant General James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, has been caught basically propounding a falsehood, and doing so in a way that seems to reflect both the desires of the administration and, well, the demands of the Islamists. I'm thinking particularly of an episode in February of 2011 when he testified in open session before the House Intelligence Committee, as you'll recall, that the Muslim Brotherhood was, quote, a largely secular organization, unquote, and one that was nonviolent or had eschewed violence. Does this constitute firing offense, do you think, this latest episode, if indeed it turns out he's been politicizing intelligence and promoting really a party line that is deceptive to the American people?
If Republicans can uncover evidence that he put out his assessment because of pressure from the White House, then yes, that would be a firing offense. And I'm surprised.
Except it would be the president who would have to fire him.
I would have to fire him, exactly. How ironic. But you're right. Sometimes Mr. Clapper says things that have your head, that has you scratching your head. I mean, the day after the attack, the CIA station chief said this was a terrorist attack. The DIA briefed in the Pentagon that it was a terrorist attack. Eyewitnesses on the ground who live next to the consulate said there was no demonstration, and the Western reporters reported this. Yet the DNI stuck with his conclusion for several days, and the White House ran with it, even though they received an email from Tripoli, the Tripoli embassy, hours after the attack, saying that this was likely the work of Ansar al-Sharia, which is an al-Qaeda-linked group operating in Benghazi. So how could the DIA come up with this conclusion? And I haven't heard an explanation of that since. You know, we know why the administration would be want to blame this on demonstrators right from the get-go. They had a security team in Libya that was made up of special operations forces with their own airplane. If that team had been kept in Tripoli, it could have been in Benghazi in 45 minutes and found its way to that annex. And with the manpower and the firepower to defend that annex and get people out before any lives were lost. But the State Department, for some reason, pulled that team out of Libya a month before the attack happened over much protest from the team leader, Colonel Wood.
And with hindsight, on quite legitimate grounds, he was protesting. Rowan, just very quickly, and we're almost out of time, I just wanted to ask you, from what you've been hearing, and you've got excellent sources, of course, our guest is Rowan Scarborough with the Washington Times, are you hearing anybody ask the larger question here? I gather that we're not getting all the answers even to the more micro questions, but the larger question of a policy failure that goes back to something we just talked about, that President Obama has been embracing and engaging these Islamists, and this was an obvious example of that being bankrupt and dangerous to boot.
Well, I mean, I think you're seeing real politic hit the White House over this, Hamas inciting another war with Israel, where the administration is now conceding that Egypt hasn't really done very much to get Hamas to stop firing rockets into Israel. So maybe this will make the administration realize that Egypt is now in the hands of the Muslim Brotherhood, and it's not the hard and fast ally we used to have in Egypt who could, you know, crack down on Hamas and tell them in no uncertain terms that, you know, stop the rockets. Also, how are the rockets getting in to the Gaza Strip? What role is the Muslim Brotherhood doing in facilitating the movements of weapons from Iran into the Gaza Strip?
Good questions all.
Next up, Corey Shackey joins us to talk about whether Susan Rice should be our next Secretary of State. Straight ahead. To know what you think, leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com. Or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
To halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WR. RC, new choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined once again by the inimitable Corey Shockey. She is currently a research fellow at the Hoover Institution and an associate professor at the United States Military Academy at West Point. She served during the presidency of George W. Bush in a number of senior capacities, including as the Director for Defense Strategy and Requirements on the National Security Council staff. And Corey Shockey, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us, especially at a moment when it seems as though we're being set up, if I can use that expression, for a debate in which the merits of a prospective nomination by President Obama of Susan Rice, currently the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, to be the next Secretary of State, is going to be cast as a kind of a test of the sexism of the United States Senate and the relative strength of the women now making up, I guess, a fifth, or in the new Congress, a fifth of its membership. And the I just wonder what your thoughts are on this, especially against sort of the backdrop of what we're learning about her role in the Benghazi Gate affair.
I have two reactions to it, Frank. The first is that sexism will actually
cease to exist in these United States when her gender doesn't matter and she gets treated every bit as badly as a man would get treated, who goes out and makes a suspiciously advantageous case on the basis of unproved information in order to help a political candidate she supports. I don't think she actually ought to be protected from the rough and tumble of politics just because she's a woman, nor should any of us be expected to be protected on the basis of our gender, no matter what that is.
Right. And the candidate, of course, that she was favoring, as you say, is the president of the United States, then being standing for re-election. And
there are legitimate grounds to be concerned about the policy line that she took. The information was unclear, and instead of making manifest that this was a fast-moving situation, we weren't sure what was happening, she took a strident line on five different Sunday shows suggesting that the sole basis for the attack in Benghazi was the anti-Muslim video. And the CIA station chief in Libya had already conveyed, significantly before that, had already conveyed back to the director of Central Intelligence the belief that the video had nothing to do with this on the basis of first-hand accounts collected in Libya. The CIA station chief was convinced that this was a terrorist attack.
Corey Shackey, among the other functions that you served in the previous administration was as the deputy director of the Policy Planning Bureau of the State Department. You were obviously very, very senior in that organization, and you know the kind of information flows that an ambassador to the United Nations would have. Does it sound credible that, given what we know about the real-time feed, apparently, from Predator drones into the State Department, that indeed the ambassador would have only been going on the basis of talking points that now seem to have been, manipulated, shall we say, to suit that presidential candidate?
It seems plausible to me that in a fast-breaking set of circumstances, that's not what she said. It's insistent that she knew what was going on, and that what was going on was that it was only the anti-Muslim video that was reinforcing this. So she is now trying to hide behind the suggestion that that she didn't have the proper information. But in fact, the proper information was available. She made a choice about what to emphasize in it.
Right. That, I think that's really the key point. And fast moving it was for a time, but this presentation on these five different shows was five or so days later. Corey, you've written about the whole issue of the military standards that have now become a focus of controversy in the light of this Benghazi Gate business and General Petraeus' role in it, and then the scandal that has now erupted around him. Talk to me a little bit about the condition of the United States military as you see it, and how the standards or the erosion of the standards should be of concern.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually not concerned either about the standards or about their general erosion, despite several high-profile cases of indiscretions and even criminality on the case of some of our military leaders. In the particular case of the Petraeus scandal, it does seem to me that the military has a proscription on adultery in the Uniform Code of Military Justice for reasons that don't have to do so much with morality as they have to do with good order and discipline in the ranks, that military leaders need to have moral authority over people whose lives they put in danger. And commanders have discretion in whether to pursue even proven cases of adultery on the basis of their judgment about what that individual's actions do to both the respect for the institution and the ability to command a unit. And so it's a reasonable standard. It seems to have been violated in this case. And so it doesn't strike me as particularly problematic that people are concerned about the director of Central Intelligence and the commander of the war in Afghanistan about their judgment in those circumstances, because we're relying a whole bunch on their judgment. The counterbalance to that, I think, is that in the days when we had military conscription, we knew that our military wasn't different and better than the rest of us because they were our brothers and our husbands. And now that such a small proportion of the American military is, of the American public is in military service, we have a kind of weird tendency to ascribe to them virtues that we ourselves don't possess. And I think that's actually bad for us.
And yet, I think you've argued persuasively that we do need to have a standard that ensures good order and discipline and the moral authority to exercise it. So I think you're not arguing that the standards be diminished to make these people turn into the rest of us with all of our faults.
We hold our military to a different standard than the rest of society. And we do that for reasons that have to do with their function, which is fighting and winning the nation's wars. And before we impose our broader social values or social aspirations on them, we ought actually to remember that they exist different from us for a reason. And the reason is that we need them to win the country's wars.
Corey Shockey, you've written an important article a while back entitled How America Should Lead. And one of the questions that you addressed recently was the role of foreign policy in the recent election, or the absence of foreign policy as an electoral issue. In your judgment, did the American people give President Obama a mandate for the kinds of policies he's pursuing, and did they explicitly repudiate a Republican alternative, or was it simply not something that they addressed or focused on at all?
I don't think it was much focus in the election, and therefore I don't think it constitutes a mandate for the president. But I do think the president is accurately reading a public mood of exhaustion with the burdens of the wars that we've been fighting and the strategies by which we have chosen to fight them. I think my own sense is that Americans feel like this is really hard, and they don't see the purpose of some of what we are trying to achieve, especially in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But, of course, leadership doesn't constitute in following public attitudes. It constitutes in explaining to the public why what needs doing should have their support. And I don't think the president has done that. Most especially, he has failed to do that on the wars.
Mm-hmm. And I would argue, I think that's a very, very well taken point. I would argue that failing to provide that kind of leadership in an environment in which, in part because of his policies on the wars, among other things, including the policies that we were touching on earlier with respect to Susan Rice and embracing these Islamists, is making the world a lot more dangerous. And so sort of pandering to, or at least simply leading from behind the public, if I can use that phrase, is likely to get us in a lot more trouble. Corey, unfortunately, we're in trouble with the clock. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope we will be able to visit with you again soon after Thanksgiving, and that you have a very happy one in the meantime. And thank you for your service to our country, past, present, and...
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Today's security environment for executives, elected officials, and dignitaries has changed dramatically. To address new security challenges, you need the veteran-owned private security firm Independent Security Advisors. The team at ISA has over 20 years of experience in providing dignitary and executive protection. ISA's network of licensed security providers are global and available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Independent Security Advisors has partnered with the University of Maryland Police Academy to provide provide one of the most respected dignitary protection training programs in the country. ISA custom training programs will fit within your budget and are designed to meet your organization's specific requirements. Take advantage of ISA's other services, such as security consulting, electronic surveillance detection and mitigation, or private and secure travel services. Contact Independent Security Advisors at info@dignitaryprotection.us or visit their website at dignitaryprotection.us. That's dignitaryprotection.us.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Obama administration is trying to keep Israel from acting to stop the deadly rockets and missiles fired at it from the Gaza Strip. Yet, Mr. Obama's policies have encouraged the jihadists responsible for such attacks. And his insistence on a ceasefire will have the effect of protecting the perpetrators and encourage them to redouble their efforts to murder Israelis. These are the same Obama policies that contributed to the assault in Benghazi, Libya, that recently killed four Americans. And they are likely to result shortly in the overthrow of the Kingdom of Jordan and perhaps others in the Persian Gulf. By engaging, legitimating, enriching, and in some cases arming the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamists, Mr. Obama has only emboldened these jihadists. And we are in their crosshairs, not just Israel. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at SecureFreedomRadio.com.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement? And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
I'm a champion. Realize Shaq's mechanism.
Hi, Shaquille O'Neal for Rad. This is not your normal PSA. Don't be stupid. Don't drink and drive. If you're going to go out and have a good time, it's fine. But designate a driver to drive home. Let's stop the madness. Don't drink and drive.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260. In Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We are joined by Stephen O'Hearn. He is a retired United States Air Force colonel who served with distinction in Iraq as a counterintelligence officer, and one of the outfits that he had to go up against was the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which was active in and deadly to our forces and interests in Iraq during our efforts to stabilize the country, having liberated it. And Colonel O'Hearn has written a very important book on the subject of the threat that grows while America sleeps. It's entitled Iran's Revolutionary Guard. And Stephen O'Hearn, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It is a real treat to have you with us because this is a topic about which we're deeply concerned here, and I think in a desperate need to know a lot more, and I think this book renders a real service. So thank you for joining us to talk a little bit about it.
Frank, thanks very much for the invitation.
Talk to me, first of all, about the IRGC, as it's best known, and specifically what its role is on behalf of the Islamic Republic of Iran's regime, and its relationship to a couple of other outfits that we hear a lot about, Hezbollah and the Al-Quds Force.
Certainly. The Revolutionary Guard was created shortly after Khomeini returned to Iraq and to Iran and took power in 1979. During the revolution, many groups had participated in the revolution, and a lot of the heavy lifting had been done by secular Iranians and even communists and Marxists. And so the Guard was formed, and they literally helped consolidate power for Khomeini and his fellow believers. They pushed out and even at times exterminated others who opposed the idea of Islamic government. And they're literally pledged to the preservation of Islamic government in Iran, as well as extending Islamic government to other areas of the world. As part of that, they literally formed Hezbollah, a group of the Revolutionary Guard deployed to Lebanon in 82, and even while fighting Iraq during the Iraq-Iran war, the Revolutionary Guard devoted considerable resources and money to forming Hezbollah. And shortly after its formation, the attacks against America started.
Mm. And they continue, of course, to this day against certainly our interests and allies elsewhere around the world. When you look at the relationship between Iran, its Revolutionary Guard Corps, Hezbollah, Quds Force, is there any question in your mind, Colonel O'Hearn, that what we're dealing with is an official extension of the Iranian regime, that when it does indeed, as you say, put American blood on its hands or those of others, the regime itself should be held accountable?
Oh, absolutely. It should.
There's no plausible deniability here, in other words.
Right, right. The commander of the Revolutionary Guard reports directly to the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ali Khamenei, and the commander of the Quds Force, and I'm glad you brought that up, because it's the beyond the borders operation of the Revolutionary Guard. The commander of that, General Soleimani, reports directly to the Supreme Leader as well. So there is no getting around that whatever the Revolutionary Guard has done has the blessing of the regime. In fact, probably the direction, I'm sorry to interrupt, Frank, but even the direction.
Good. So the war that is being waged against us and our allies and interests, notably, of course, Israel, is in fact directed by and under the authority of the regime. Let's talk a little bit about that war. You've mentioned in your book a character that is in the news at the moment, unhappily. His name is Ali Musa Dakduk. I'm sure that you confronted this character, or certainly people like him, but tell us his story and what has happened that puts it in the news at the moment.
Dakduk is a senior Hezbollah operative. He spent most of his time in Hezbollah in what's described as either the external security operation or the special security apparatus. It's the part of Hezbollah that actively operates in terrorism and other military operations. One time he was the head of Hassan Nasrallah's security detail.
The head of Hezbollah. So he's a very senior dude. Yeah.
Yes. At one point he was ordered into Iraq, and there worked hand in hand with the Quds Force, helping train and guide the Shiite militias that were the active hands that were setting off the explosively formed projectiles and other explosives against U.S. forces and the Iraqi security forces. Dakduk had a strong hand in that. And one particularly infamous operation was in 2007 against the Karbala Provincial Center, when the center was penetrated with SUVs that appeared to be Americans, American SUVs, people in American uniforms. They killed a U.S. soldier, kidnapped four, made a getaway, obviously intending to seize them and hold them hostage. Only through the intervention of an Iraqi SWAT team were they surrounded and cut off. The perpetrators escaped, but not before they shot and killed the four handcuffed American soldiers. That was an operation that was detailed on Dakduk's laptop that was seized with him when he was captured by the British SAS.
Wow. And he has recently been released, as I understand it, having been turned over to the Iraqis when we left the country. Is that your understanding? And do you know what's become of him?
Well, he's, according to news reports, he's in Lebanon now.
Is it safe to say back in the fight?
Oh, yes. Yes. Somewhere there is some American interrogator, probably several, who actually spoke with Dakduk. Because although he pretended to be deaf-mute initially, he eventually began talking. And a lot of what we know comes from what he told us. And he is no doubt a very senior element of the operation against Americans in Iraq. And now he has been released, an example of what happens if you just wait us out.
3, 2, 1. We're speaking again with Colonel Stephen O'Hearn, the author of Iran's Revolutionary Guard, The Threat That Grows While America Sleeps. We're almost out of time. I'm sorry to say, Colonel, I hope we can get you back to do proper, deeper drill down on this. But just very quickly, tell us about your concerns about the IRGC's operations inside the United States and the threat that they pose here.
As I mentioned, the IRGC literally formed Hezbollah. And Hezbollah has leveraged the very widespread immigration of Lebanese into all parts of the world, including the United States. And within the United States, there are many Lebanese who are very honest, hardworking citizens of the U.S., but there are also some who are either active Hezbollah supporters or sympathizers. And they support Hezbollah financially, largely through financial crimes such as counterfeit products, designer goods, that sort of thing, and other types of financial crimes. But they also are routinely conducting surveillance operations against infrastructure targets. There have been several Hezbollah cells detected. The most notable one was the one in Charlotte, resulted in imprisonment of its leaders. But my book also describes how the IRGC itself has placed people into the U.S., and the most public example of that was the recruitment of the U.S.-Iranian native who had planned to kill the Saudi ambassador.
Yeah. But right in Washington, D.C. Stephen O'Hearn, this is a terrific contribution to an understanding we desperately need about an enemy that is at war with us and has been since 1979, the Islamic Republic of Iran. Thank you for this terrific book, Iran's Revolutionary Guard. Check it out, folks. And Stephen O'Hearn, I hope you'll come back to us and, as I say, drill down a lot more on this in the very near future.
Went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medication, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet. The diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call. And I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Dennis Prager thinks there should be a simple standard to textbooks.
I'll tell you how I think a textbook should be written. This is what happened. Period.
That is the role of the text.
And if nearly everybody who did something important in American history, if 78.9% of them were WASP males, then I want 78.9% of the textbook to reflect that fact.
I care about truth.
That's why I'm not on the left.
The Dennis Prager Show.
Up in the morning and out to school.
Weeknights at 10 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by our friend Gordon Chang. He is our duty expert and that of a great many others on matters involving Asia, including Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com. He is also a regular contributor to the musings on these issues of Fox News, and I am delighted to have you with us, as always, Gordon. We have, of course, as we speak, the President of the United States meandering around Southeast Asia and the Western Pacific. What do you make of his trip? Is there anything substantive to be expected out of it, or is it really mostly photo ops?
This is mostly symbolic, but the symbolism is important because what it's saying is that the United States will lead in Asia. And you can see the president is going around the periphery of China to Thailand, Burma, and Cambodia. This really is the non-military aspect of the pivot, because the pivot was more than just about moving the Navy and Marines to Asia. It was also about concentrating America's diplomatic and trade initiatives towards the region. And so it's a good thing.
Mm. Are you concerned at all, Gordon, that some of the changes that we are seeing and that the president has touted in Burma this past 24 hours may be a bit tentative and a bit premature to be extolling as he is?
It is premature. Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel laureate, was concerned about the president going to Burma. Since then, there have been intensive discussions between the White House and her, and she now is satisfied. But clearly, there is a rush to embrace the generals, and that really means that we may be ignoring some very important values like democracy, human rights, and the rest of it. So, yes, this is a concern, and we're going to have to be very careful in terms of balancing our desire to have better relations with the Burmese generals. And also, on the other side, our values, which are, of course, much more important.
Yeah. Gordon, one other thing that, of course, has happened since we last spoke to you is the final playing out of the Chinese transition. The development that I guess is the most unexpected of it all is this question of Hu Jintao stepping down as the chairman of the military commission. We talked about this a little bit prospectively last week. You were uncertain whether he would or whether he wouldn't. What do you make of the fact that he did? And more generally, the nature of the new lineup in Beijing?
Well, it's a good thing for Chinese stability that Hu Jintao, the just departed leader, is no longer chairman of the Central Military Commission. What's very interesting, though, is that Hu had very little influence on the makeup of the Politburo Standing Committee, which is the apex of political power, but Hu did pack the top of the military with his generals and admirals. And so now there is at least some potential for conflict there. The really important thing that emerged from what we saw at the end of the 18th Party Congress was that Jiang Zemin, who was Hu Jintao's predecessor, has packed the 7-member standing committee with 4, but probably 6 conservatives. And in this context, conservative doesn't mean what it does in our political system. It really means anti-reform reactionaries. And so essentially what we've got is a group in China which is going to lead the country backwards. And so this is going to be a problem. The number 3 ranked official in China, by the way, is a North Korea-trained economist. You know, you just can't make this stuff up, Frank. And so what we're going to do is really see how far they manage to take China backwards in terms of economic reform, economic matters. As certainly political reform is completely, completely off the agenda.
Interesting. And Gordon, I wanted to visit with you in that regard in connection with a interesting piece written by John Garneau in Foreign Policy magazine. It is entitled National Socialism with Chinese Characteristics, and it describes a fellow that I expect you know, Hei Di, former very successful sort of Western-style capitalist businessman who has created something called the Buyan Foundation. Tell us what this refers to and whether there's reason to be concerned that a kind of Nazi-style merger of state capitalism and extreme populism and nationalist impulses may be what's in the offing in China and the implications of that if it is.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of concern that China is going to become a fascist nation if it isn't one already. And it certainly shares some key characteristics with fascist nations, militarism, ethnic-based nationalism, and territorial expansionism. It also lacks some key characteristics like mass mobilization and a charismatic leader. But, you know, by this definition, by the classic definition of fascism, 1930s Japan was not fascist. But we think it to be because, of course, it was allied with two states that clearly were, the Third Reich and Mussolini's Italy. So China may not be fascist, but it is dangerous. And that really is the important point about all this, because China is on a path that is taking it into conflict with its neighbors, and that's going to drag in the United States. So China clearly at this point, you know, whether we think it is fascist or not is even more than just a cause for concern. It really is the number one threat to peace and stability in the world.
Yeah. And Gordon Chang, you've been saying that for some time, of course. This is not a news flash, but does the transition that we've now seen accomplished say anything to you about an increased probability of this trajectory? I mean, we certainly are hearing a lot of nostalgia, it seems, in certain circles for the old communist past. And I gather this fellow Hey Dean, and you may want to say something about him, you know, is very apprehensive about the undoing of the kind of economic reforms and the aspiration, at least he claims, for a more modern society with a constitution and the rule of law and so on. But is there a point at which sort of a return to some of the bad old days of Chinese-style communism and this sort of fascist impulse, if you will, might be, you know, converging in a way that will, as you say, be very dangerous for us as well as bad for the Chinese people?
The transition isn't over yet. Chinese transitions formally take about 3 or 4 months, and it won't end until the National People's Congress meeting in early March of next year. And then they generally sort of bumble on for another 2 years as new leaders consolidate their positions. What's really been worrying about this transition, as we've seen it so far, is the military has been breaking free of civilian control, the People's Liberation Army becoming so much more powerful in the Chinese political system, and perhaps is the most powerful faction in the Communist Party. And that's why over the last 2 years, we have seen so many of these troubling incidents between China and its neighbors. He Di, who is the object of John's piece, really represents sort of the best thinking in China today among the elites, because he does want the things that everybody else wants. He wants more say in his life. He wants rule of law. He wants security. And these things the Communist Party is not willing to give. And as we've seen, the party is going backwards on all of these important points. So that's the reason why we're concerned. You know, whether China is fascist or not, it doesn't really matter. What matters is the direction China is taking right now. And it also matters that China is not happy with its place in the world, and it's willing to use military force to take the territory of others.
Yeah. And just to come back to that point you just made, Hu Jintao apparently packing the military with his trusted officers. Do you anticipate that that will indeed further this trajectory of the Chinese military in a more aggressive stance? Did they get out of this transition increased authority as we fear?
Yes, I think that they have. It'll take some time to actually confirm that. But what the important point is, China's external behavior recently has really been very, very worrisome. And we don't see anything to stop that trajectory as China seeks the territory of its neighbors and actually seeks to deny freedom of navigation to the international community, including the United States, and is willing to use forceful tactics to drive the U.S. out of Asia. So clearly, with the new generals and admirals in place, this does not look like it's going to get any better.
As you say, Gordon Chang, we will know more later. In particular, we will know more about whether they are dissuaded from all of this by the president's tour in Asia and his pivot to that part of the world. Gordon, we look forward to visiting with you as this story unfolds in the week ahead, and we look forward to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.